Once, while still in the Illinois Senate, I listened to a Republican colleague work himself into a lather over a proposed plan to provide school breakfasts to preschoolers. Such a plan, he insisted, would crush these children's spirit of self-reliance. I had to point out that not too many 5-year-olds I knew were self-reliant, but children who spent their formative years too hungry to learn could very well end up being charges of the state. Despite my best efforts, the bill still went down in defeat. Illinois preschoolers were saved from the debilitating effects of cereal and milk. But my fellow legislator's speech helps underscore one of the differences between ideology and values. Values are faithfully applied to the facts before us, while ideology overrides whatever facts call theory into question. I often wonder what makes it so difficult for politicians to talk about values in ways that don't appear calculated or phony. Partly, I think, it's because those of us in public life have become so scripted, and the gestures that candidates use to signify their values have become so standardized. The stop at a black church, the hunting trip, the visit to a NASCAR track, the reading in the kindergarten classroom, that it becomes harder and harder for the public to distinguish between honest sentiment and political stagecraft. Then there's the fact that the practice of modern politics itself seems to be value-free. Politics and political commentary not only allows but often rewards behavior that we would normally think of as scandalous. Fabricating stories, distorting the obvious meaning of what other people say, insulting or generally questioning their motives, poking through their personal affairs in search of damaging information. The gap between what we deem appropriate behavior in everyday life and what it takes to win a campaign is just one of the ways in which a politician's values are tested. In few other professions are you required, each and every day, to weigh so many competing demands between different sets of constituents, between the interests of your state and the interests of the nation, between party loyalty and your own sense of independence, between the value of service and obligations to your family. There's a constant danger that a politician loses his moral bearings and finds himself entirely steered by the winds of public opinion. Perhaps this explains why we long for that most elusive quality in our leaders, the quality of authenticity, of being who you say you are, of possessing a truthfulness that goes beyond words. My friend, the late U.S. Senator Paul Simon, had that quality. For most of his career in Illinois politics, he baffled the pundits by garnering support from people who disagreed, sometimes vigorously, with his liberal politics. It helped that he looked so trustworthy, like a small-town doctor, with his glasses and bow tie and basset hound face. But people also sensed that he lived out his values, that he was honest, and that he stood up for what he believed, and perhaps most of all, that he cared about them and what they were going through. That last aspect of Paul's character, a sense of empathy, is one that I find myself appreciating more and more as I get older. It is at the heart of my moral code, and it is how I understand the golden rule, not simply as a call to sympathy or charity, but as something more demanding, a call to stand in somebody else's shoes and see through their eyes. Like most of my values, I learned about empathy from my mother. She disdained any kind of cruelty or thoughtlessness or abuse of power, whether it expressed itself in the form of racial prejudice or bullying on the schoolyard or workers being underpaid. Whenever she saw even a hint of such behavior in me, she would look me square in the eyes and ask, "How do you think that would make you feel?" But it was in my relationship with my grandfather that I think I first internalized the full meaning of empathy. Because my mother's work took her overseas, I often lived with my grandparents during my high school years. And without a father present in the house, my grandfather bore the brunt of much of my adolescent rebellion. He himself was not always easy to get along with. He was at once warm-hearted and quick to anger, and in part because his career had not been particularly successful, his feelings could also be easily bruised. By the time I was 16, we were arguing all the time, usually about me failing to abide by what I considered to be an endless series of petty and arbitrary rules, filling up the gas tank whenever I borrowed his car, say, or making sure that I rinsed out the milk carton before I put it in the garbage. With a certain talent for rhetoric, as well as an absolute certainty about the merits of my own views, I found that I could generally win these arguments, in the narrow sense of leaving my grandfather flustered, angry, and sounding unreasonable. But at some point, perhaps in my senior year, such victories started to feel less satisfying. I started to think about the struggles and disappointments he had seen in his life. I started to appreciate his need to feel respected in his own home. I realized that abiding by his rules would cost me little, but to him it would mean a lot. I recognized that sometimes he really did have a point, and that in insisting on getting my own way all the time, without regard to his feelings or needs, I was in some way diminishing myself. There's nothing extraordinary about such an awakening, of course. In one form or another, it is what we all must go through if we are to grow up. And yet I find myself returning again and again to that simple principle. How would that make you feel? As a guidepost for my politics. It's not a question we ask ourselves enough, I think. As a country, we seem to be suffering from an empathy deficit. We wouldn't tolerate schools that don't teach, that are chronically underfunded and understaffed and underinspired, if we thought that the children in them were like our children. It's hard to imagine the CEO of a company giving himself a multi-million-dollar bonus while cutting healthcare coverage for his workers, if he thought they were in some sense his equal. And it's safe to assume that those in power would think longer and harder about launching a war if they envisioned their own sons and daughters in harm's way. I believe a stronger sense of empathy would tilt the balance of our current politics in favor of those people who are struggling in this society. After all, if they are like us, then their struggles are our own. If we fail to help, we diminish ourselves. But that does not mean that those who are struggling, or those of us who claim to speak for those who are struggling, are thereby freed from trying to understand the perspectives of those who are better off. Black leaders need to appreciate the legitimate fears that may cause some whites to resist affirmative action. Union representatives can't afford not to understand the competitive pressures their employers may be under. I am obligated to try to see the world through George Bush's eyes, no matter how much I may disagree with him. That's what empathy does. It calls us all to task, the conservative and the liberal, the powerful and the powerless, the oppressed and the oppressor. We are all shaken out of our complacency. We are all forced beyond our limited vision. No one is exempt from the call to find common ground. Of course, in the end, a sense of mutual understanding isn't enough. After all, talk is cheap. Like any value, empathy must be acted upon. When I was a community organizer back in the 80s, I would often challenge neighborhood leaders by asking them where they put their time, energy, and money. Those are the true tests of what we value, I'd tell them, regardless of what we like to tell ourselves. If we aren't willing to pay a price for our values, if we aren't willing to make some sacrifices in order to realize them, then we should ask ourselves whether we truly believe in them at all.